From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The restored version of the Orson Welles classic film Touch of Evil has just been released on DVD and video. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with film editor and sound designer Walter Murch, who helped restore the film based on notes left by Welles. Murch also did sound for the Godfather trilogy, The Conversation, and Apocalypse Now. Also, a pioneer in electronic music, we hear from Robert Moog, the inventor of the Moog synthesizer. Book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews One Market Under God, and David Bianculli reviews the new Charlie's Angels movie. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Last month, Francis Ford Coppola, George Lucas, and other filmmakers gathered to honor Walter Murch at a tribute produced by the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. Murch is a film editor and sound designer who has been nominated for 8 Academy Awards. He won in the categories of sound and editing for The English Patient, which made him the first person to win in both categories for the same film. He also did the sound for Apocalypse Now, The Conversation, The Godfather Trilogy, and The Talented Mr. Ripley. He worked on the restoration of the Orson Welles classic Touch of Evil, which has just been released on DVD and video. He'll talk about the restoration in a few minutes. First, we're going to hear Michael Ondaatje's comments about Murch, recorded last month at the Academy tribute to him. Ondaatje wrote the novel The English Patient.
Driving the curving road into San Francisco, Walter Murch glances down at the speedometer and says, "This car has almost reached the moon." "What?" He says, "The distance to the moon is 238,713 miles. This car has gone 238,127 miles. And most of it has been on this winding road." This is a typical Walter Murch piece of small talk. He's a man whose brain is always peering over the wall into the world of scientific and technical knowledge. The book on his table that he is probably reading is Our Place in the Cosmos by Harlan Wickramasinghe. He's written In the Blink of an Eye, a wonderful book on editing. He has translated the works of Malaparte. He doesn't watch television at all. He doesn't watch too many other movies when he's working on one himself. As a writer, I discovered during my peripheral involvement with The English Patient that when I watched Walter Murch edit, this was the stage in film that was closest to the art of writing. Walter likes to quote the dictum that a film is born 3 times, in the writing of the script, in the shooting, and in the editing. With The English Patient, there were in fact 4 births, and I'd like to chart and show how different and variable these births are in terms of one scene. In the novel of The English Patient, there's a moment when Caravaggio, whose hands are bandaged, watches a dog drink from a bowl of water and remembers how he was tortured 3 years earlier. Something about the table he is sitting at begins this quick flood of memory. The scene is about 2 paragraphs long, and the dog beside him is in the present, and the torture scene is in the past, and they merge. He doesn't want to face that traumatic moment, so it is vaguely, intentionally vaguely remembered. It is dreamlike, not at all realistic. When Anthony Minghella wrote the script, the scene went on for about 4 pages of sharp and frightening dialogue. It was now a scene where the German interrogator, not Italian as in the book, tries to break down the defenses of the court spy, Caravaggio. In order to link Caravaggio more to the crimes of The English Patient, it is clear in Minghella's version that Almasi is the cause of the capture of Caravaggio, which leads to the torture. We are therefore already a long way from the scene in my book. In the novel, the past just haunts them at a certain moment, but none of this torture is described in detail, just suggested. Minghella's scene, brilliantly written, has tense dialogue repeated again and again, with the interrogator casually circling around to catch him by surprise. The next 3rd birth was the shooting of the scene. As Willem Dafoe, who played Caravaggio, said, "We shot the hell out of the scene." And they did, at least 15 takes, and then close-ups, an opening razor, close-ups on the typist recording the interrogation, a fly crawling over Caravaggio's hand that buzzes off as the razor enters a frame. I remember one stunning take where the camera stayed on Defoe's face all through the scene and stayed with him as he pulled the table he was handcuffed to all the way to the back of the room to avoid that razor. When I saw the assembly, this was the moment in the film I thought most remarkable. In any case, Minghella had taken another step forward from the written screenplay with the shooting of the scene. Now he gave it to Murch. And what did Walter do with this scene? Well, he had been reading the Italian writer Malaparte on the Nazi character, and he plucked from his reading the fact that the Nazis hated the showing of weakness. If they witnessed it, they were so appalled they would try to force that weakness out of you by exerting even more cruelty. This idea was certainly not in my book, not in Minghella's script, not in the 25 minutes of footage that had been shot and which had now had to be cut down to a terrifying 3 minutes. Every scene for Walter needs to have a larger science of patterns at work within it. And this was going to be the idea or concept that governed the way he cut the scene. At one point, Caravaggio Defoe says, when he sees the razor, don't cut me. He says it once. Walter has the interrogator pause in his questioning when he hears this, extending the time of the response. He has threatened the spy with the idea of cutting off his thumbs, but only in a casual way, not serious way. When Caravaggio says, don't cut me, the German pauses for a moment. The interrogation continues. At some point, Walter found another take of Defoe's line, this one with more of a quaver in the voice, and he decided to put it in again a few seconds later. So Defoe repeats his fear, his weakness, and now time stops. We see the look on the German, and now we know he has to do what he was previously just theorizing about. To emphasize this, Murch, at this very moment, pulls all the sound out of the scene and plunges the soundtrack into silence. And we, if we don't realize it as we sit in the theater, are shocked for some reason, and it is because of that quietness. Something terrible has been revealed about the spy, about his own nature, and now something terrible is going to happen. Up till now, Walter has built numerous layers of sound to give us the feeling of being within that cave-like room. He even provides sounds taking place outside the room, a favorite device of his. In this scene, there is the sound of firing squads outside, soldiers yelling, typing, flies buzzing, telephones ringing. Then when Defoe repeats that line, which in reality he did not repeat, which was not even there in the script, Murch makes the response to the line a total and dangerous silence. Walter has said that the use of silence in movies did not come in until the invention of synchronous sound in 1927. Till then, there was the continuous accompaniment of music, live orchestra, organ, or piano. As an editor, he always tries to find a moment in his films to have that shock of silence filling the theater. And in this film, it happens now. It feels as if it lasts 5 minutes, but in reality, just about 5 seconds. And during that time, all is decided. And after that moment, all hell breaks loose. This is where members of the audience begin to close their eyes and where some faint. In fact, they probably faint because they close their eyes, because we see nothing violent on the screen. But we hear the suggestions of it. And the ones with closed eyes are now under the control of this master sound editor, and so they imagine it all. Thank you.
Michael Ondaatje wrote the novel The English Patient. His comments about sound designer and film editor Walter Murch were recorded at last month's Academy tribute to Murch. Murch was the editor and sound mixer for the restored version of the Orson Welles 1958 film Touch of Evil, which has just been released on DVD and video. The film is generally acknowledged as one of Orson Welles' great achievements, but it was first released as a B-movie and flopped at the box office. The audience never saw exactly what Welles had intended. The studio did the final cut, and that version infuriated Welles. In response, he fired off a 58-page memo explaining his original intentions. The complete memo was tracked down a few years ago by Rick Schmedlin, who used it as the basis to produce the restored version of the film. The restored version follows Welles' intentions as outlined in the memo. Touch of Evil is set in a seedy town on the Mexican border. Charlton Heston plays a Mexican narcotics officer honeymooning with his new bride, played by Janet Leigh. The honeymoon is quickly interrupted by a bomb explosion, which Heston feels compelled to investigate. But he's up against a corrupt American police chief, played by Orson Welles. Murch describes the opening shot as a Rosetta Stone for film students, a shot that is logistically and technically difficult, which is made to look effortless.
The shot is a 3.5-minute long single take, which involves the population of an entire city, a very lively border town at the crossing between the United States and Mexico. And you begin on the Mexican side of the border with a big close-up of a pair of hands putting a bomb in a car, turning the clock to 3 minutes and 20 seconds, which justifiably becomes the entire length of the shot. So he predicts right at the beginning of the shot how long the shot will be, because that's when the bomb will go off. And then the camera cranes way up into the sky, and has a overview of this entire street and this almost the entire city, and then drops way down to street level, sees people on the street, and then picks up Charlton Heston and Janet Leigh, who play the leads in the film. And then the car with the bomb in it comes into the shot and leaves the shot, and then there's some other bit of business, and the car comes back. So it's a very complicated shot that ends with a whole dialogue scene, still part of the same shot. And then the dialogue scene ends, the Charlton Heston and Janet Leigh go off, and they have a kiss, and then right when in the middle of their kiss, the bomb goes off. So everything is contained except for that final bomb within this single shot.
Now, in the released version of the movie, this spectacular shot is obscured by the opening credits. And also, Henry Mancini music plays, you know, the opening credit music plays over this entire scene. Now, that's not what Orson Welles wanted. What did he want?
Well, let me just read you from his memo. This is a document that he wrote in a single night. It's about 58 pages long. And he was allowed by the studio to see his film one time only. He had been fired off the film effectively 4 months before the film was finished. And those are four extremely critical months in the life of any film. He saw what they'd done to it. He saw that they had written new scenes, added new dialogue, shot whole new sections of the film. And this is his response. He begins, actually, with talking about this very thing. This is Orson Welles talking now. "I assume that the music now backing the opening sequence of the picture is temporary. In fact, it was not. This was Henry Mancini's title music. Then, as the camera moves through the streets of the Mexican border town, the plan was to feature a succession of different and contrasting Latin American musical numbers. The effect, that is, of our passing one cabaret orchestra after another. In honky-tonk districts on the border, loudspeakers are all over the entrance of every joint, large or small, each blasting out its own tune by way of a come-on or pitch. The special use of contrasting mambo-type rhythm numbers with rock and roll will be developed in some detail at the end of this memo, when I'll take up the details of the beat and also specifics of musical color and instrumentation on a scene-by-scene, transition-by-transition basis." You can get from that paragraph the depth of detail that he was going to go into in this memo. But what we read there was our instructions from Welles about what to do. Once the titles had been eliminated from that opening shot, and we were very lucky to find what's called a textless background, which is just the images without any titles on it. So we found that negative, and we were able to use that to integrate into the rest of the film and have that shot have no titles over it. So now you can see everything that's going on in the shot. The way it was, you had to look around the titles to see what was actually happening in it, which Welles hated.
Now, had Welles recorded all the sound that he wanted to use there? And if so, did you have access to that recording? Or did you have to do the sound from scratch for that opening scene?
Well, that's another interesting thing. We actually found the original sound for that scene. Not the music part, which I had to manufacture by lifting pieces from other places in the film, of music that he had also used in the film. Strip joint music, rock and roll music, mambo, cha-cha music, all coming out of little tinny loudspeakers, which he had recorded. But once the Henry Mancini original title music was on, the studio made the decision to eliminate almost everything of the effects track, the sound track that Welles had also produced. So the sound of people walking, the sound of the crowd, the sound of a group of goats that they come across in the middle of the shot, the car sounds, all of this was really absent. And when you heard the previous version of the film, your memory is of nothing except Henry Mancini's music. So by eliminating Mancini's music, we were also, surprisingly, because we didn't know it was there, we were able to reveal this whole other dimension to the film, which has never been heard before.
Let's hear how that opening scene sounds. We won't hear all 3 minutes of it, but we'll hear some of it and hear that kind of a very varied sense of different cultures in one town that he wanted to establish in this opening.
Okay.
Sound from the film Touch of Evil. We'll talk more with Walter Murch about restoring the film after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Walter Murch. He was the editor and sound mixer for the restored version of Orson Welles' 1958 film Touch of Evil. It's just been released on DVD and video. Now, I believe Orson Welles, in this long memo that he wrote to the studio telling them why they should do the film the way he wanted it cut, he said that the sound in this scene should be as bad as it would have been in real life. I mean, he wanted the sound from these speakers and car radios to be really tinny, like in real life. So that's instructions that you followed.
Yes, absolutely. This was a very revolutionary thing at the time. In 1958, when you made a film and you put music to it, everyone's impulse was to make the music sound as good as possible. This is roughly the equivalent of when you're shooting a scene in a slum. Even though it's a slum, it's not really dirty. There's a whole other aesthetic that says, make it as dirty as possible. And that was what Welles was following in his use of music here. Again, let me just read from his memo. And I should emphasize that this is the only time in the whole memo that he goes into a narrow column with capitals. It's very big. It says, it is very important to note that in the recording of all these numbers, which are supposed to be heard through street loudspeakers, that the effect should be just that, just exactly as bad as that. The music itself should be skillfully played, but it will not be enough in doing the final sound to run this track through an echo chamber. To get the effect we're looking for, it is absolutely vital that this music be played back through a cheap speaker in the alley outside the sound building. Since this is not very expensive, I feel justified in insisting upon this, as the result will really be worth it. Now, right in that, you can get a sense of how mysterious Orson Welles was to the studios, because here he's saying at the beginning of it, it should be as bad as it really is, as bad as possible, and at the end he says the result will really be worth it. And this was a mentality, certainly at Universal in the late 1950s, that people just had a hard time understanding. But it adds to the realism, and since that time, this technique is now universally applied in film. But in 1958, it was completely outside of anyone's experience.
Now, one of the things that the studio changed was Orson Welles' cross-cutting in the movie. There are two main characters, Janet Leigh and Charlton Heston, play an American and a Mexican who have just married. He's a cop. And the story kind of alternates between her point of view and his point of view. He's investigating the murder while she's getting terrorized by the bad guys. And the film cuts back and forth, and I guess the studio found that really confusing.
This happens in the opening reel of the film, and Welles had intended the two stories, that the married couple gets separated quite soon after this explosion, and for the rest of the film, really, we're following their two independent stories, which finally get linked up together at during the climax. This was also was a not a usual technique for any films in 1958, particularly B films. So they felt, at least in the opening reel, let's make it all normal. We'll just play the whole scenes. We'll play them out as they were intended to be as full scenes. This is their interpretation. The trouble with that is that you're grafting on the limb of a tree onto an animal. That the two things just don't mesh. The whole film is about cross-cutting. So if you make the first reel not be about cross-cutting, then you're essentially teaching the audience to understand this film in a different language than the rest of the film will be. So that was probably the main note that Orson had in this entire 58-page memo was restore my cross-cutting. It's essential because each story is equivalent. The man's story is just as important as the woman's story and vice versa. And I want each time we go back and forth for it to be not too long and for each section to be just about the same length. The way it was, you spent 5 or 6 minutes with Charlton Heston. Janet Leigh was long gone by that point. So at the end of 5 minutes, you probably thought you were justified in thinking, yeah, this film is about Charlton Heston. So then when it goes to Janet Leigh and her story, you're thrown for a loop.
Walter Murch, he was the editor and sound mixer for the restored version of Touch of Evil, which has just been released on DVD and video. Our interview was recorded in 1998. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, from BEA, an e-commerce transactions company providing end-to-end solutions for the development and deployment of e-business applications, BEA.com. And from Random House Incorporated's Delacorte Press Division, publisher of The Colwood Way, a memoir, new from Homer Hickam, author of October Sky. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk with Robert Moog, the inventor of the Moog synthesizer. He also manufactures theremins, the eerie-sounding instrument we're listening to now. Maureen Corrigan reviews One Market Under God, and David Bianculli reviews the Charlie's Angels movie. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In a new book called One Market Under God, leftist social critic Thomas F. Frank gives new meaning to the by now familiar slogan, "It's the economy, stupid." Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
I've devoted my life to the study of literature for lots of reasons, and one of those reasons is that I'm afraid of math. Whenever anyone begins talking about mortgage rates or mutual funds, I go into brain lock. So I'm not the kind of person who ordinarily would be interested in a book about the current economy, or more precisely, a climate of thought about the current economy. Except the book in question, called One Market Under God, is by Thomas Frank, a founding editor of that smart, literate magazine of social criticism, The Baffler. Frank is a thoughtful and impassioned observer of his own time. In the great Anglo-American tradition of outraged sages like William Cobbett, Thomas Carlyle, Twain, and Mencken, Frank understands that wit can be the greatest ally of anger. In One Market Under God, the target of Frank's anger is what he calls pro-corporate market populism. The arrogant notion, he says, that markets express the popular will of the people more articulately and more fairly than do mere elections. In the new economy of the 1990s, according to Frank's bemused take on things, markets are seen as the friend of the little guy. Zillionaire entrepreneurs like Bill Gates are hailed as lovable outcasts, and the New York Stock Exchange has become the house of the people, a place whose invitations of affluence are now extended to small investors, like those emblematic Beardstown ladies. All that age-old nonsense about class conflict, Frank Riley says, has disappeared in this brave new economy. Liberated workers are supposedly being empowered by their personal computers and the booming stock market. They no longer need pension funds or unions or government regulations. When those same workers are downsized out of their jobs, they're encouraged by the pop therapeutic culture to see unemployment as an opportunity to engage in a search for personal authenticity. To criticize market populism is to run the risk of being labeled a cynic, an egghead, or an anti-democratic elitist. Frank deftly repels all those barbs with his abundant reason and gallows humor. The new economy of the 1990s, he drolly comments, produced a populism of acquiescence in which endless salutes to the people's power covered the people's growing powerlessness, in which constant talk of popular wisdom served mainly to justify the ever-widening gap between rich and poor. It was a 1930s without the New Deal, all CAPRA, no CIO. Frank's argument in One Market Under God is so rich and provocative that any quick overview like this runs the risk of dumbing the book down and drying it out. He devotes chapters to incisive discussions of how he thinks this radical political shift in attitude toward big business came to be. He surveys the contemporary literature of management theory that enthuses about the corporate soul and promotes superficial employee freedoms like casual dress codes and pet-friendly offices. Frank has a lot of fun, in a horrified sort of way, analyzing the new populist-era business ads on TV that use 1960s rock soundtracks to legitimate their company's rebel status, as well as images of children and indigenous peoples to attest to their genuineness. Looking closely at events like the Microsoft antitrust case and the World Trade Organization protests in Seattle, Frank characterizes as topsy-turvy the logic that rendered the opponents of big business in those cases, specifically the Justice Department and labor unions, as elitist defenders of special interests. And in Withering Screeds, Frank claims that most journalists and academic intellectuals, particularly the cultural studies crowd who like to fancy themselves as resistant to dominant ideologies, have become little more than pod people propagandists for the new gospel of market populism. According to that gospel, which Frank dissects, the marketplace offers a more perfect vision of democracy, and the goal of business is service and universal affluence. Like I said before, I'm not a numbers person, but Frank has me convinced that something here doesn't add up.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed One Market Under God by Thomas Frank. Coming up, Robert Moog, inventor of the Moog synthesizer. This is Fresh Air. Thank you.
Electronic music is so pervasive now we take it for granted, but it was a new concept in the mid-60s when Robert Moog created the first music synthesizer. The Moog synthesizer generated sounds electronically. It caught on in all forms of music, from the avant-garde to classical, rock, and novelty. The synthesizer became more accessible to musicians and composers after Moog made his first portable, the Mini Moog, in the early 70s. Now Robert Moog lives in Asheville, North Carolina, where he heads his company Big Briar, which manufactures Moogs and theremins. The theremin is the eerie-sounding instrument that has been used in many science fiction films. Moog wrote the introduction to a new book called Theremin, Ether Music and Espionage. When we spoke earlier this year, he brought a Mini Moog to the studio with him. I asked what the Moog synthesizer could do that couldn't be done before.
The very first electronic music modules that I made could make dynamically varying sounds, sounds that moved in musically interesting ways, sirens, trills, whistles, effects that modern composers had been trying to get for a while with conventional instruments, but really responded to when they could get them electronically.
Demonstrate what you mean.
Okay, so here's a plain sound. This is a pure electronic pitch. And now I will frequency modulate it. By that I mean that I will vary the pitch of its tone periodically. So most people would say that was a different sound than just this. Now I can speed up and slow down the modulation, or make it a different shape. Here's what we call a square wave. It makes the tone sound like a trill. So that's just one example of how we can use one electronic circuit to periodically even aperiodically change the operation of another one and make musically interesting sounds in the boot and in the process.
Now, what were you using to adjust the sounds that you just made? Was it a keyboard, knobs, buttons?
Yeah, let me describe the instrument that I'm using here. It's called a Mini Moog. It has a keyboard. That's just one control device. The most important control devices are a panel full of 27 knobs, and there are what we call left-hand controllers, wheels on the left-hand side of the keyboard that we can also play in a live performance musical situation. But in a demonstration like this, I'm using it just as if it were a knob.
Now, you know, regular instruments, acoustic instruments, operate through physically doing something to the instrument. You pound it, you press it, strum it, bow it, blow air into it. Compare that with the principles of an electronic music instrument like the Moog.
The energy to make the sound is there. It comes out of the wall.
So electricity.
Yes. So the what I'm doing is controlling the sound. It's as if I'm driving a car rather than pulling a wagon. I'm steering the sound with my hands.
So what you're doing is actually like changing the shape of the sound wave, as opposed to pressing on a drum, pounding on a drum or something.
That's right.
And so your knobs allow you to just change the shape of a sound wave.
Yes.
The amplitude, the shape of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we can increase the complexity of the sound. For instance, there's one tone. Now we can add a second tone. Here's one, the other, together. They form a richer third tone. So we can add sounds and waveforms together. We can use one waveform to shape what we hear from another circuit. And we can also filter out the overtones, the harmonics that are made by these waveforms.
You want to give me an example of that?
Here's, let's get a brighter sound. There. This is called a low-pass filter. Originally, it was a technical term, but musicians these days, at least ones who plug in, understand what that means. So I'll close the filter, and we'll cut out first the higher overtones and then all of them. Now, when I bury the filter slowly like that, you can hear what's happening, that the sound is getting more mellow and less bright as I turn down the knob here labeled cutoff frequency. But if instead of my turning the knob, I use a waveform that goes up and then down every time I hit a key, we'll get a sound like this. Now, that opening and closing of the filter was done not by me, but by the envelope generator. Now, I'll make it faster, and you'll see what effect that has on the sound. And still faster. Now, that happened so fast that if I had to do that with my hand, I couldn't possibly, because my hand can't move that fast. But electronics can move that fast. So now I have a different sort of sound. I have a plucked string-like sound. Because I've set up a sound here that's bright and with lots of harmonics at the beginning, and then within, say, 30 or 40 thousandth of a second, it dies down and our ear identifies that as a string-like sound.
So it's through this kind of principle that you're able to mimic the sounds of many instruments.
Yeah. Not only can we mimic the sounds of many instruments, but we can make many new sounds. You know, for instance, I'll change the operation of the filter a little bit with the knob called emphasis here, which now emphasizes one harmonic or overtone at a time, and we'll get... We'll get that sort of sound, which is more vocal than string-like. Turn up the emphasis a little bit. So now we're getting such strong emphasis that it's actually a separate whistle from the sound.
Now, your Moog synthesizer was designed to do things that a piano could never do, yet you gave it a piano keyboard. Did you ever consider an alternate design since you were creating a new system altogether?
We considered a lot of alternate designs, and in fact, the first synthesizer systems that we built in the mid-60s had a wide variety of control devices. Besides the keyboard, we had a device called a ribbon controller that you run your finger along as if it were a violin string. We had drum controllers. We even had doorbells, We experimented with everything, joysticks, we arrived at a keyboard because, A, musicians were familiar with it. B, at that time, they were readily and cheaply available so that we didn't have to spend a lot of money on tooling. And B, it did serve a musical purpose at least some of our customers wanted served. Not all, but some of our customers were interested in playing conventional melodies and harmonic content from a keyboard.
Right, exactly. I mean, you know, on the one hand, you had like Walter Carlos, later Wendy Carlos, mm-hmm. performing Switched on Bach using the Moog to play a kind of newfangled sounding version of Bach. And at the same time, you had a lot of avant-garde composers and musicians using the Moog synthesizer to create a kind of avant-garde music that hadn't been possible before.
That's right. One of our first customers was Vladimir Usachevsky, who at that time was the head of the Columbia-Princeton Electronic Music Center. He's sort of the grandfather of tape music in this country, and he was interested in getting away from the keyboard. He bought quite a few electronic modules from us, but he never bought a keyboard from us.
Other records from the 60s, when you were first, in the early 70s, when the Moog was first catching on, that you think sound almost embarrassingly dated today?
The first use of the Moog synthesizer on the West Coast sounds embarrassingly dated. It's a record called Zodiac Cosmic Sound.
How can that not sound dated?
Well, what happened is this was in 1967, and we were wondering whether we could stay in business because we weren't making any money and nobody understood our products. We were invited to exhibit our new synthesizers out at the Audio Engineering Society in the West Coast. So at that exhibit, we were then invited to bring this one instrument that nobody had ever seen out there to a recording session of Zodiac Cosmic Sounds. And the synthesizer was used to make some distinctly novel electronic effects, one of which begins the album. But what the album is, it starts off with very conventional sounding Hollywood movie music. It was a mono record too. Imagine how dated that is now. It was 1967, was a mono record. So it starts off that way, and then with a low organ tone, the narrator comes on. He had a voice as deep as crude oil, and he said, "Nine times the color red explodes like heated blood. The battle's on." Then ba 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 ba, like that. The producers at the time were very impressed with themselves about how in this was and how hip and how many they were going to sell. Now when you play it, people just break out laughing.
So is the bum ba bums that you were doing on the synthesizer?
No, they were done more or less conventionally.
Where did the synthesizer come in?
The synthesizer came in making just drop-in sounds. Let's see if I can set one up. The Mini Moog is really not big enough to do all the sounds that we did, but let's, for instance, start with one sound. Wait, another sound. Okay. So that's about a whole tone apart. I'll add a third sound. Okay. Now, that's the general sort of sound that they liked. Just glide up a little bit here. That sort of sound.
Great. Yeah.
Now, with the large synthesizer that we had back then at the studio in Los Angeles, you could glide more slowly, you could add more frequencies, you could make a sound that was fairly striking for those times.
Robert Moog recorded earlier this year. He wrote the introduction to the new book Theremin, Ether Music and Espionage. Coming up, David Bianculli reviews the new movie Charlie's Angels. This is Fresh Air. The new movie Charlie's Angels is an adaptation of the 1970s TV series, which made stars of Farrah Fawcett, Jacqueline Smith, and Kate Jackson. TV critic David Bianculli reviewed the series back in 1976. He saw the new movie and has this review.
There's a lot of revisionist history going on about what Charlie's Angels meant to the 70s. A lot of talk about empowerment and women doing it on their own terms and positive feminine role models. But I was there and watching closely. And I have one word to say about all that. Here's the one word. Ha! Back then, Charlie's Angels both pioneered and exemplified a genre of TV programming that came to be known, I'm not kidding about this, as Jiggle TV. It was a TV show with a definite and almost defiant absence of bras, and viewers could watch with the sound turned off and not miss any of the important points. Charlie's Angels was one of the most popular shows of the era, and a poster with Farrah Fawcett jump-started the fantasies of millions of teen boys. For girls, the women of Charlie's Angels were more like action Barbies. Yes, they always beat the bad guys, but that wasn't as important as how good they looked doing it. Whether they were going undercover as disco queens or sitting around taking speakerphone orders from their unseen boss, Charlie, they looked marvelous. Backstage, the real energy of Charlie's Angels didn't go into the scripts. It went into the wardrobe and makeup trailers. To put it bluntly, Charlie's Angels was a pretty bad TV show. And that made it possible to hope for good things from the new Charlie's Angels movie. When Hollywood tries to make a movie remake of a good TV series, it usually fails miserably. I'll cite The Avengers and rest my case on that awful example alone. But when it revisits a show that was campy to begin with, like The Brady Bunch, the results can actually be superior. This time, the three angels are played by Drew Barrymore, Cameron Diaz, and Lucy Liu, and sidekick Bosley is played by Bill Murray. That's good casting across the board. So all that remains is to find the right tone, tell a good story, make it visually interesting, and let audiences sit back and enjoy the ride. The references to the old show are there. There are slow-motion hair flips and lots of silly undercover disguises and happy laughter at the end of the adventure. An action montage during the credits even has the new angels chained to one another in the same blue prison uniforms as in the old show. And the case begins, as it always did, with the voice of John Forsythe delivering exposition through that boxy speakerphone.
Good morning, angels.
Good morning, Charlie.
Dylan, Alex, Natalie, I hope you're rested and ready for your next assignment. Meet Eric Knox, a brilliant engineer and the founder of Knox Technologies, an up-and-coming communication software company. Last night, Knox was kidnapped, and his voice identification software was stolen.
Who's the lady left behind?
Vivian Ward. She's the president of Knox Technologies.
Oh, she did it.
Well, I guess we can all go home then.
Angels, meet Vivian Wood, our new client.
Each angel gets at least one showcase moment during the movie. Diaz gets hers when her bubbly character gets to be a featured dancer on Soul Train. Liu gets hers when she gets to play a variation on the leather-clad dominatrix she played in the Mel Gibson movie Payback. And Barrymore gets hers in disguise as both a fantasy blonde pit crew member and the bubbliest member of a Swiss singing trio. This new Charlie's Angels is rated PG, so any sex appeal is about as tame as it was in primetime. But it's still overt, with the message that these women use their sex appeal aggressively, like any other weapon in their arsenal. They're all master martial artists doing the same physics-defying Hong Kong movie stunt moves that were mainstreamed by Hollywood in The Matrix. And I guess the most commendable thing about the 2000 vintage of Charlie's Angels is that the heroines don't carry guns. What's not commendable about this new movie are its pace and tone. It's so choppily edited, with such an incessant music soundtrack, that most parts of the movie play like outtakes or trailers rather than finished scenes. The three angels are given just enough time to establish character traits, but Bosley and the villains are shortchanged. And as anyone who's ever seen a James Bond or a Batman film can tell you, the better the villain, the better the movie. Bottom line, I was disappointed by this new Charlie's Angels. Even though I loved some of the costuming, the geisha girls, the belly dancers, the rock band, even when they went undercover as guys, Charlie still comes off as a long-distance pimp, and too many scenes come off as frenetic, disconnected, or out of sync. But one woman at the screening I saw insisted, and I quote, "A lot of young girls are going to like this movie." So I passed that on for what it's worth. I guess the retro glamour that worked then still works now. But my recommendation is just a pass, period.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shirok directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with music from the new CD by clarinetist and composer Don Byron. Tonight at a concert in New York, he pays tribute to Henry Mancini and Sly Stone. Byron's new CD is called A Fine Line. This is a Four Tops hit played as a duet with Uri Caine.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Random House Incorporated's Delta Division, publisher of The Plutonium Files, America's Secret Medical Experiments in the Cold War by investigative journalist Eileen Welsom. From Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. And from Random House Incorporated's Delacorte Press Division, publisher of The Colewood Way, a memoir, new from Homer Hickam, author of October Sky. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actress Anna Deavere Smith. She's written a new memoir. And we talk with Julia Query. Her new documentary is about unionizing the dancers in the strip club where she works. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Hold on a second. Should I ask Bob? What's good for you?